came to pass, when the evil spirit from God was upon Saul, that David took a harp and played with his hand. So Saul was refreshed and was well, and the evil spirit departed from him. Many people imagine heaven as a place where they hear the sound of the harp. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
References to the harp pervade the Bible. What is the history of this instrument, and what sort of harps and harp music exist today? Joining us to explore the harp is Chelsea Bowles, professor of music in the Department of Liberal Studies in the Arts and in the School of Music at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, practicing harpist, and the author of A Harp in the School, a guide for ensemble directors and young harpists.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
And thanks for bringing your harp.
Huge instrument. This is not the kind of harp that David played, I take it. This is large and unwieldy. Although it sounds graceful, it's got to be the most inconvenient instrument from an orchestral standpoint because you have to lug it around. It's not like a piano where you can just use the one that's there. How did things come to this pass?
Well, it took hundreds and hundreds of years to do that, to get to the big instrument that we have now. The instrument I'm playing today is a concert pedal harp, and it's pretty well standardized. This is the harp that most people see in symphony orchestras and in chamber music and so forth. But yes, you're right. It's not at all the size or type of harp that David would have played. We don't really know much about that particular harp, but we do know quite a bit about now about historical harps and so forth, which we'll talk about in just a moment.
Well, how far back do you find images of harps or references to harp? It must be B.C. by thousands of
right,
years.
Right, antiquity, yes. It's probably the most pervasive instrument that you see in iconography and you hear references to. It's got to be one of the oldest ones that way. It's a very pervasive instrument that way. And it's also pervasive worldwide. I mean, almost every culture that we know of has some sort of harp. And so it's an instrument that obviously lots of people played over centuries and centuries.
Well, what does it have to be a harp?
That's a good question, because a lot of things are called harps that are not really harps. The harp is triangular in shape, the shape that most people are used to seeing. The biggest part of the triangle is the body of the harp, the sound box, and it has a soundboard on top of flat board. And then coming up from the base of that triangle is a column, and it's sometimes called a four-pillar. And then at the top is a string arm, and it has a beautiful harmonic curve. I think that's just such a beautiful name for this curved piece at the top. And that piece is very important because that's where the strings are tied, and that's where the tuning mechanism is.
And why the curve?
Pardon?
Why does it dip down in the middle of this top?
It has to do with the length of the strings and just the way the back of the instrument comes up and sits on the harpist's shoulder.
And you use your fingers. Can you just do a glissando once?
Sure.
Okay, so you're using all your fingers except the little one?
Yes.
Yes.
That's true. In playing this instrument, the thumb and then three fingers on each hand are used. The little finger is not used just because the hand position is not, you just can't really reach. If you're playing properly, you really can't reach the strings with a little finger. So that's kind of a technical problem for some composers. It's a difficulty, too, when people are trying to transcribe music from piano music, which is definitely, uses five fingers on each hand. And so everything can't really be transcribed really fluidly for this instrument because, well, for a lot of reasons, but that's one of them. It's an eight-finger instrument, and it is possible to play bigger chords and things, but of course then you have to alternate your hands to get to the top of the chord and so forth.
Harpists usually look like they're working pretty hard.
That's right, they are. And you know what? Most people only see the hands. They don't see what's going on with the pedals, which I'll get to a little bit later. That's really the work part. I'd say half of the work is what's going on with the pedals.
And why do you think it is that harps are associated with this sort of sense of peace and heaven? I mean, even when you just played those opening glissandos, I felt as if all my cares were washing away and you're being soothed by this sound. What is it that gives it that kind of angelic sound.
I don't know, but it is true. I mean, this is a gorgeous sounding instrument, and there is something about the movement of the strings and even playing this instrument, except when it gets really hairy. But playing this instrument is actually quite therapeutic, and there's a whole science of harp therapy. But I can't tell you what it is. It's one of those kind of unexplainable things. And if you were able to see this instrument, you would also be able to see that it's a very beautiful-looking instrument. Sometimes when people, especially as adults, want to play this instrument and they're really reticent to get started because it is daunting, I guess, when you sit down behind this instrument, I always say, you really don't even have to touch it. I mean, you can actually just roll this out on stage and people will ooh and ah before you've actually done anything at all. You can play Mary Had a Little Lamb on this instrument. It sounds beautiful.
Can you give us an example of an early piece where the harp is used to accompany a song?
Yes. I selected a piece today that was composed in about 1281. It's a Scottish song. The harp is being played by William Taylor. The harp that's being used is a wire-strung medieval harp. And unlike today, where most harps that people see in orchestras and so forth, a kind of a standard size instrument, historical harps were of all kinds. They had different features about them, maybe with the neck or the four-pillar or something like that. They all looked quite different. There was no standard for harps, and they might have been strung with wire, or they might have been strung with gut strings, or kind of whatever was available. And so harps sound quite different from each other, the historical harps, and they look quite different. The piece that you're going to hear is a wire-strung instrument and would have been quite typical of the medieval period and the way harps were used during that time.
Next ilux auritur, o dulcis Scotiae, quae vere nocitur fulgens Norvegiae, quae cum transveitur trahi
As you can hear, that was a pretty simple accompaniment, and that might have been similar to an accompaniment that would have been played on King David's harp, I expect. The harps were small, the range was small, so there wasn't a lot of melodic playing that we know of. It was really very quite simple accompaniment, and the harps were tiny. A little bit later, harps were actually used melodically, especially with dance music, and often played with other instruments. I selected some dance music played by Cheryl Ann Fulton with Ensemble Alcatraz, which is a really wonderful group. She's playing a little bit bigger harp. It's still a medieval style instrument, but it's a little bit larger harp, and it's a gut-strung harp. So it's quite a bit more active than the piece we just heard. During the Renaissance, things began to happen with the harp. It grew, for one thing, larger range. The harp itself became larger, louder. You could actually play with more pressure and so forth. So the harp had a lot more capabilities in the early Renaissance. The piece that you're going to hear now is a piece by Bartolomeo Tramoncino. It's an Italian piece. And we think it was probably composed for harp. So we know that starting with the early Renaissance, we did actually have pieces composed for harp. We're not sure that this one was, but we think it was. This is a larger Italian harp, gut strung again, played by Becky Baxter. Thank you.
It's a much more modern-sounding harp, but I do have to wonder, after hearing those medieval pieces, how often would a harpist have to tune back then?
Oh, very often, just like now.
Well, I noticed you spent a lot of time tuning before we started today.
Right. It's a major thing. No matter how beautifully someone plays this instrument, if it's out of tune, people really know. I mean, even if they don't know anything about music, they can tell when an instrument's out of tune. And, of course, it's a particular problem if you're playing with other instruments and everybody has to be in the same tuning. So it's a major thing for harpists.
What did Stravinsky say about the out-of-tune harp?
Stravinsky said something like, I don't know if this is an exact quote, but he said something like, harpists spend half their time tuning and half their time playing out of tune. And that's quite true.
One thing that you hear in those early pieces is just that it's limited to sort of the whole notes of the scale rather than the sharps and flats. That must have limited what composers could do with the harp.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, it became quite a problem, even in the middle to late Renaissance. Composers were really wanting to do more with their music than the harp could actually do, tuned what we call diatonically. That is like the white keys on the piano. So I'm just going to play a diatonic scale. That's it. For those early harps, I mean, you could... The range was bigger, but those were the notes that were available unless you tuned differently. So to get those black notes on the piano keyboard, which I'm going to call chromatics, just to make it easy to talk about this, if you needed a chromatic note, you had to do that before you started playing. And then there was no possibility of changing that in while you were playing, of course, and it became quite a problem. Plus, if you were doing like a multi, say you were doing a dance suite or something, and you were playing with other instruments, they would have to wait in between the movements of the dance suite for the harpist to tune the instrument to whatever key that the piece was in. So this became quite unworkable, really, for composers starting with the middle Renaissance and increasingly more of a problem in the Baroque and classical periods, and we'll get to that in just a moment. There was a lot of experimentation with harp building, trying to deal with this. You can't really just have all the notes on there because pretty soon the harpist can't really reach. If you actually had the 12 notes of the scale, the chromatic scale, in several octaves, pretty soon the harpist can't really reach to play the instrument. And so several things were tried. They tried putting the string somewhere else on the harp, kind of. They tried cross-strung instruments where the chromatics were crossed through the diatonically tuned notes, and that was horrible, of course, because they were really very difficult to play, and you had to play low with one hand and really high with the other hand, and that really changed the sound of the instrument. Although there are still some cross-strung harps, not many people play them anymore, and that was not a successful solution to the problem. A more successful solution was to string the harp with several rows of strings parallel to each other. So a double-strung harp would have two rows of strings, one of them strung chromatically and one diatonically. But if you can imagine the way this looks, it's visually a very difficult thing to kind of sort through. Plus, you were limited with one hand to playing chromatics and the other hand playing, unless you could reach through. And that was very difficult because the strings have to be far enough apart to actually let a finger through, or several fingers through, and a thumb. So it was kind of a problem. The most successful instrument was called arpadopia, which was actually a triple-strung instrument. So I guess they were strung in different ways, but the most successful one, I believe, had two rows of diatonically tuned strings on the outside with one chromatically tuned row in the middle. And that instrument was fairly successful, but like I said, it's a bear to play. I mean, it's a bear to even sit behind and look at all these rows of strings and reach through and so forth. It's quite difficult to play. But I selected a piece by a real master of playing the triple strung harp or the arpadopia. This is Andrew Lawrence King, and he is playing a piece by Dowland that was written for lute, but is actually playable on that triple strung harp. And I chose this particular one because you can actually hear the chromatic changes when the harp moves to a key that's not really a diatonic sounding key. So this is Andrew Lawrence King playing a Dowland lute piece.
Andrew Lawrence King, a very capable player by any account there with what could be, in most of our hands, an unwieldy kind of harp. Back with a look at the modern concert harp and what it can play in 30 seconds. This is University of the Air.
Public Radio's Winter 2007 membership drive was supported by the following Madison area businesses that provided food for our volunteers. We thank Cousin Subs at 6628 O'Dana Road and Bon Thai at 944 Williamson Street, Madison.
The harp arrived and rather added to her beauty, wit, and good humor, for she played with the greatest obligingness, with an expression and taste which were peculiarly becoming. A young woman, pretty, lively, with a harp as elegant as herself, and both placed near a window, was enough to catch any man's heart. That's from Jane Austen's Mansfield Park from 1814. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Chelsea Bowles, and we're talking about the harp. Chelsea, when that came out in 1814. The illustrations show Mary Crawford playing on a harp that doesn't quite look like the one you've got in the studio with you. It wasn't 6 feet tall or whatever that is, and it didn't have the petals like you've got now.
Yes, that would have been kind of probably a single row instrument, diatonically tuned, and the person would have had to tune it by hand before every piece and so forth. Or it could have been a harp that had levers at the top, and we'll actually talk about lever harps a little bit later because that's still a very popular harp and people do hear that harp quite often. But as we discussed earlier, the problem of chromaticism and getting to those chromatic notes on this instrument became quite a debilitating factor for composers. They really were not free to compose what they really wanted to do. And there's a whole body of fabulous composers like Beethoven who didn't actually compose for harp because it could not do what could be done with other instruments. So harp makers really got to work on this. Actually, the person that is responsible for really putting the harp into place as a kind of a contender with other instruments was Sebastian Erard, who was a person who was actually probably primarily a harpsichord builder, but he put himself to this task of figuring out how to make the harp a fully chromatic instrument. And what he did was actually put feet into use. That had been done a little bit before with hook harps, which were instruments that were controlled. The mechanism at the top of the harp where the strings are strung were controlled by some pedals, at a limited number of pedals at the bottom so that you could actually change pitch of a string. So I'm just going to play a string, and I'm playing the same string by just moving a pedal. The hook harps were able to do that one thing, and the harp makers didn't necessarily put pedals on all seven notes of the diatonic scale. So it was a little bit better than not being able to do anything, but still there was a problem of not having every key possible and being able to easily go from key to key and so forth. So what Sebastian Arard did was to take the instrument and figure out how to make every single string able to play flat, sharp, and natural by putting in a pedal at the bottom of the harp operated by the feet, and each pedal has three positions, sharp, natural, and flat, and each of the pedals controls all of the like notes on the harp. All of the Fs are controlled by the F pedal, all of the Gs, all of the Cs, and so forth. So it's a complicated thing to talk about, really, without being able to see this. But I'm just going to play a little bit so that you can hear what I'm talking about. I'm playing the same string, okay? Well, I'm going to play two strings, actually. No, I'm going to play four strings, I think. Now, I played the same strings all the time, and all I did was to move my foot on the pedal that controls those notes, and those happen to be Cs. It's a very, very complicated mechanism. The pedals are connected to pedal rods that run up the four pillar, inside the four pillar, and connect to all this very complicated mechanism at the top. It did several things. Not only did it make the harp capable of playing chromatically, but it made the harp very heavy and very, very expensive. A modern pedal harp is really quite expensive, but it has to be because the mechanism is quite extensive. And you in the studio here can see that it's quite involved. And harps are handmade still, even the mechanical parts. So it's quite expensive. But it did make this instrument kind of survive in the classical music world. Otherwise, I think it would have been passed by.
Because it wasn't chromatic, you mean?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
exactly.
And of course, we know that the trumpet went through the same metamorphosis at the beginning of the 19th century, and that instruments do fall by the wayside or survive, depending on how adaptable they are.
Right.
So what are some classical pieces, then, that once you had this remodeled type harp that could play all the notes, how does that start sounding then when you take pieces that would not have been written for the harp and put them to the harp?
Now, one of the first things that happened was that really beautiful music that was not playable on the earlier harps was actually adapted to this harp, and like, you know, Bach preludes and so forth that would not have been playable on other instruments. Or maybe they were playable, but not many people could play them. I've selected an example of a Bach prelude. This is Yolanda Kananisis, who will actually be in Madison next year at the Wisconsin Union Theater. She's a very fine harpist. And this is a recording of a Bach prelude played by Miss Kananisis.
Not written for a harp, but certainly beautiful on a harp.
Oh, indeed.
But what happens when we actually get a harpist writing for the harp? Is there something you can say that really was written for a harp and nothing else?
Well, it's just the best possible of all worlds. Although some harpist composers are really great harpists, and so some of the music they write is really quite difficult. But they really know the instrument, and they know what sounds good on the instrument, and they know what keys sound best on the instrument and so forth. So, like I said, it's really the best of all worlds to be able to play a piece of music on the harp that was written by a harpist. What you're going to do now, this is a piece by Marcel Ternier. This is Lily Lasquine playing a beautiful piece of music.
Certainly, I hear the only for harp kind of sound, the beautiful glissandos, cascading notes and everything. Does the harp always have to sound so nice?
No, it doesn't. In fact, it sometimes really sounds not quite nice at all.
But so far, we haven't heard anything ugly or harsh or angry. It's always got this peaceful sound.
Yes. Actually, a lot of composers in the 20th century started exploring and experimenting with the sounds that were actually distinctive, that really only the harp could make. The piece you heard just now, I guess it could be played on piano, but it wouldn't sound as beautiful as it does on the harp. But there are sounds that you can really only get on this instrument and have them sound the way they do. In a moment, we're going to hear a piece that incorporates some of these techniques that I'm about to demonstrate, but I just thought I would run through some of the techniques that are particular to the harp. One of them you heard earlier, it was that glissando. This is the typical sound that people are used to hearing and they think of when they think of harp. That sort of thing. So forth. Very Marx Brothers. So that's really a sound, because of the way you can manipulate the pedals on this instrument, that's a sound that only the harp can really make. Another thing is playing with the nails. This particular effect is called falling hail.
Falling hail.
Anyway, I'm just playing with the back of, you know, with the back of my fingers with the nails, and that's quite popular. That became quite popular. Another one is actually plucking with the nails themselves, like this. Which which is a little bit hard to do because you don't really have long fingernails.
Well, I was going to ask, is it ever required to get like prosthetic fingernails to pull off any of these pieces?
Not really, because they're usually embedded in a piece of music, and you know, you just have to figure out how to do it.
So. Why wouldn't you just use a pick like a guitarist would do?
Well, you have to pick that pick up and hold it with your hand, which means you can't use your fingers. You know okay. what I mean? Some composers have experimented with, instead of using the back of the nails for the falling hail effect, you can actually use a pick and it's much louder. And some composers actually say what you're supposed to use, like a clothespin or a... So it can get quite interesting. Another special thing, actually a lot of instruments can play harmonics, but with the harp, it has a particular bell tone. Let me see if I can get one here. It's quite a nice tone. Next to the glissando, I would say that's the most frequently used special effect for this instrument. Another thing you can do with this instrument, because the way the pedals are arranged, is you can get kind of a tremolo effect, and I'm playing two different strings, but because I can manipulate the pedals, then I have this tremolo sound, which you can get on other instruments, but you wouldn't think you could get that on harp, but you can. So one of the interesting things that happen when all of these special effects begin to be incorporated into music is that nobody knew what to call them and how to notate them. And it's still a problem, actually. Some of them have been kind of codified, I guess, and there are certain symbols for certain things. But really the safest thing for a composer to do is say the sound the person wants, and if they have something in mind, say, this needs to sound like a saw or something like that.
That's an interesting question.
And that really happens quite often, but there are a lot of special effects that a harpist sees a particular symbol and he or she knows to do certain things. I selected a piece that has quite a few special effects, and it was probably written to actually show off the harp and these various special effects. It was a piece written by Carlos Salcedo, who was also a harpist and quite a prolific composer in the early 20th century for harp. This is Song of the Night, and it's played by Suzanne MacDonald. Thank you.
With all this expanded range of possibility for the harp and so on, do you have pieces that are written specifically for harpists to be the soloists, concertos for harp?
Oh, yes, definitely. Really, there are quite a few concertos now for harp and orchestra. I would say that probably, in my experience, Debussy was really the first composer with Ravel who really knew what this instrument could do and was able to integrate it into the orchestra in a very satisfying way. We're going to hear a concerto called The Dances, but even Debussy's orchestral music was so integrated with the orchestra. It's so much fun to play because, for one thing, you play almost all the time. You don't have to count so much, and you really feel a part of the orchestra. It's not, okay, suddenly the harp has to play, and the harp has to be really loud and heard and so forth. It's really a part of the music, and Debussy, and really Ravel as well, knew what to do with this instrument. So what I'd like to have played now is some of the Debussy dances for harp and orchestra, and you can kind of hear what I'm talking about. Even though it's a concerto, there are also portions in which the harp is a part of the texture of the orchestra. That was Marcel Grangeny playing the Debussy dances Sacred and Profane, although we never got to the profane part. Marcel Grangeny was also a fantastic and world-renowned harpist who was also a composer.
And we will listen to the sound of the folk harp and the Celtic harp in just a moment. This is University of the Air.
The businesses, professionals, and organizations that support Wisconsin Public Radio's programming play an important part in our financial health. When you visit any WPR sponsors, please let them know that you appreciate their support of this station.
Grenya Yates with the Irish harp, and maybe the most prominent harp around today, at least the folk context of it seems to be very prominent. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, harpist Chelsea Bowles. This is so different from what we've heard so far. It must have a different kind of pedigree, these folk harps.
It does to our ears these days, to a certain extent. In the middle of the 19th century, of course, we saw that the orchestral harp or the symphony harp or the pedal harp or the concert harp or whatever you wanted to call it became somewhat standardized. But existing, of course, alongside with the classical tradition was the folk tradition. And I wanted to talk a little bit about folk harps today because they are harps that people see a lot, but they're very, very different from the concert pedal harps that we heard earlier. Most of the harps that we see today are smaller instruments than you would see on a stage with a symphony. They're also completely very much less complicated than the ones you see, and they're less expensive. They're really quite simple harps, maybe not quite as simple as the medieval harps and the early Renaissance harps, but they're quite simple instruments with a body and a wooden body in the column and the string arm, and then a quite simple tuning mechanism. Most harps that you would see today are what we call lever harps. They have limited chromatic possibilities. The harpist actually changes a lever that's on the neck of the harp, close to where the harp is tuned, where all the mechanism is. One of the nice things is that a lot of chromaticism really isn't needed for folk music. You generally start a piece and stay in the same key all the time. And then if you have to quickly go to a piece in another key, you can actually flip a few levers and be there fairly quickly. And that's the main advantage of these levers that allow some chromaticism.
Now, that was the Irish harp that we heard, and it does seem as if the harp is associated with Ireland, uses a symbol of it and everything. By Irish harp, is that different from when you hear the phrase Celtic harp?
Celtic harp terminology, that encompasses a lot of things. And the true Irish harp is the one that you heard, which is a wire-strung instrument. And it's a particular sound of instrument. The body is quite resonant. The strings are wire, and there's a whole technique of going back and damping things because, you know, the wire strings can ring kind of indefinitely, and it gets quite cluttered sonically. But the true Irish harp would have been one that was historically used in Ireland, and that would be the wire strung. The one you're most likely to see these days is probably not a wire strung instrument, but maybe a nylon strung instrument, which can more or less reproduce that sound. They're also very long, sustaining sounding strings, and so it can be more or less reproduced with a nylon-strung instrument. So a lot of the instruments that you see in the folk harp realm are nylon-strung instruments, probably lever harps, just basically for the ease of moving from piece to piece. It's really a wonderful harp and can actually do a lot of things. In fact, there are composers now who are really getting into composing for the lever harp. And it can sound quite modern, and these are more or less classical pieces. But I would like to go back to your statement about harp being the symbol of Ireland. I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here. Harp has been identified with Ireland for centuries because harp playing in Ireland was a highly skilled and treasured art. And harpists in Ireland traveled a lot, not only in Ireland but all over Europe, and people began to know about Ireland through its harpists, and they were very highly skilled musicians. So to the rest of the world was associated with the harp. And, of course, later it took on quite a political symbolism as well. Now I'll jump to the idea that modern composers are composing for the lever harp. I think we'd like to close today with a piece written by Bernard André, whose specialty is writing for the lever harp. And you'll see from this example that it can sound quite modern and complicated and interesting, even though the harp that's being played has limited chromaticism. Thank you.
Chelsea Bowles, thanks for being our guide to the harp this hour. What a pleasure.
It was a pleasure for me as well.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.
Vietnam War hardly seems like the stuff for a musical, and yet it did spawn a major hit in Miss Saigon. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 for University of the Air as we go behind the scenes in a production of Miss Saigon with singing and accompaniment here on Wisconsin Public Radio.